I'd like to welcome our viewers to this video chat. My name is Michael Fix. I'm the Senior Vice President of the Migration Policy Institute and co-director of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. This Thursday marks the first anniversary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program. And as some of you probably know, MPI has just published an issue brief that profiles the DACA population. The brief, for those of you who might not have seen it, can be found at www.migrationpolicy.org. And our analysis in this brief has been supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. During this video chat, MPI policy analysts Jana Batalova and Sarah Hooker and I will discuss some of our major findings, and then we'll turn to your questions from the audience. So I invite you to tweet your questions using the hashtag #MPIDACA, #MPIDACA, or email questions to communications@migrationpolicy.org. Sarah Hooker is an education specialist who's recently authored a major report for MPI on immigrants and their access to post-secondary education in Washington State. And Jana Batalova is a demographer and senior policy analyst here at the Institute. Both are co-authors of the report. Now, the study's analysis brings together, we think, three strands of work that have been conducted at MPI's National Center for Immigrant Integration Policy in recent years. One has been examining the demographic composition and the characteristics of the youth population who are eligible for the DREAM Act and its successor, the DACA program. A second strand of work explores how well immigrant youth 16 to 26 are served by the nation's work preparing systems. And then a third is our ongoing analysis of legislative and administrative changes in immigration reform, which many of you are familiar with. I'll just call your attention to a couple of things about the report. First, and we pledge not to say too much about this unless we're pressed by questions, I think you might want to take note of the report's innovative methodology, a methodology that examines not only applicants for the DACA process, but the pool of undocumented youth who are potentially eligible for DACA. You should know that our analysis uses a new and an innovative demographic approach that represents a major breakthrough, we think, in identifying and characterizing the unauthorized population. And Jana will say a few words about this. And then let me just say that it seems to me that the report has at least three punchlines. First, the comparatively wide and somewhat surprising levels of state variation in application rates for DACA. Second, the striking level of variation in application rates across national origin groups. And third, the wide differences that we find between the approximately 1 million youth who meet the age at arrival, and education requirements of DACA, and the 400,000 or so who meet the age and age at arrival criteria, but not the education requirements. These two groups don't just differ in their education levels. The 423,000 have more limited English skills, they have higher levels of poverty, they're much more likely to work, and they're much more likely to be parents. All will represent barriers to qualifying for the program that Sarah will discuss in her comments. So with that, let me turn to Jana Batalova, senior MPI analyst and demographer, who will say a few words about some of our more interesting findings. Jana?
Thank you, Michael, and good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Since everyone on this video chat knows about DACA in one way or another, I'll just highlight the most important features of the program. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program offers a two-year relief from deportation as well as work authorization for eligible youth brought to the United States as children if they meet certain criteria. A few other important features of the DACA program is that the applications are accepted on a rolling basis. There is no set deadline when the program ends, and that applicants can prospective youth can submit applications for DACA defensively, meaning that if they are in the custody of immigration service, then they can apply for DACA to stop their deportation. As Michael mentioned, in our research, we take a unique approach by comparing the number and key characteristics of people who stepped forward and applied for DACA, as well as to the characteristics of the total universe of people who are eligible to apply. We draw on two data sources. One is the publicly available government application data, and the second is the unique data set that we developed with two very savvy demographers from the Pennsylvania State University, their methodology allows for a fine-tuned analysis of the unauthorized population using the most recent 2011 American Community Survey data, the most recent data from the Census Bureau. I'm not going to bore you with too many methodological details, but if you're interested in them, we detail them in the appendix of our report. There are two important criteria that I'd like to highlight for the purposes of our discussion. According to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which runs the program, only applicants between ages 15 and 30 can apply for DACA currently, and they must be enrolled in school or have at least a high school diploma or its equivalent. So these two criteria, age and education, mattered a great deal in terms of who is eligible to apply as of now. So we estimated that although the overall universe of potentially eligible youth is about 2 million people, only 1.1 million is currently eligible and currently meets all the criteria, including age of arrival and education requirement. We estimate that about 500,000 of people applied in the first year, and this translates, which means that about 49%, so half of people who are currently eligible, have applied for DACA. But there are two other groups of people. One, the 423,000 youth who appear to satisfy all criteria but education. So this population must re-enroll in eligible educational program in order to be eligible for DACA. And the other population is are the children under age 15, about 392,000. They are just too young as of now to apply for the program. They will be eligible to apply once they reach age 15 and either remain in school or earn their degrees, high school diploma or its equivalent. Michael mentioned very interesting variations that we observed in the state and national origin in application rates. So let me highlight a few most interesting and in some cases surprising findings. So we define the application rate as the ratio of applications submitted to USCIS and accepted for processing to the pool of currently eligible population. We found that whereas the 49% of applicants nationwide applied, the application rates varied from the high of 74% in North Carolina, 63% in Georgia, to the low of 34% in New York and 35% in Florida. The two states that have the largest number of youth that is eligible to apply, as well as those who have applied, California and Texas, close to the national figure, about 49 and 54% respectively. But given that these two states have such large populations, they do drive the national trend. Well, the data that we have does not allow us to tell exactly why some people apply and why and others don't, and why states vary in terms of the application rates. From our research, we hypothesize that there are a couple of possible explanations. One of them is the relative urgency and importance of authorization, work authorization, and driver's license. These two documents are important for unauthorized youth and young adults, and DACA made it easier for such youth to receive these documents. Climate reception is another factor that might have played a role in the state variation. But so is the availability and cost of legal assistance to apply for DACA. We also think that demographics of the population residing in certain states, such as national origin and age, play a role in explaining state variations. So let me say a few words about national origins. Again, just to remind you, the 49% is the application rate nationwide. Youth from Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala together account for 68% of currently eligible population out of 1.1 million. However, they account for 85% the lion's share of all applicants who submitted their applications in the first year of the program. More specifically, we estimate that 64% of eligible Mexican youth have applied, and so have 58% of those from Honduras, 45% from El Salvador, and 47% of those from Guatemala. In contrast, only 14% of those from the Dominican Republic and 16% of those from the Philippines, those who are eligible, only such small percent applied in the first year of the program. Another interesting observation, we find that China ranks among the ranks ninth on our list of those who are eligible, but this national origin is absent among the top 20 states, top 20 national origins in the application data. So again, what are the reasons why we might see such a divergent rates by national origin? Without detailed interviews of eligible youth, it's difficult to say. However, we think that a few factors play out. One is that there is a greater awareness and continuous discussion about the legalization options for the unauthorized population in general, and the unauthorized youth that would be eligible for the DREAM or DACA program, that are discussed in ethnic media and community-based organizations in the Hispanic community. We also think that there is no national equivalent of Telemundo or Univision that cover immigration issues nearly daily in the Asian community. Another reason might have to do with the concentration of a certain national origin group in a certain geographical location and their access to well-organized support networks. Another interesting finding that I'd like to highlight is that there is a group of young adults and youth who can check all boxes on DACA application except for education. We estimate that there are about 423,000 youth that appear to qualify for the DACA except for the educational requirement. Some of this youth might have been able to re-enroll enroll in eligible educational programs since the DACA program was launched. But for many of them, path to eligibility for DACA will be difficult. I'm going to turn to Sarah, who will talk about this population in greater detail, as well as highlight the barriers and opportunities that this population faces on their path to apply to DACA. Sarah?
Great. Thanks, Jana. So in addition to the variations by state and national origin groups among the population that's currently eligible that Jana just discussed, I am going to go into greater detail on the characteristics of the population that is not yet eligible to apply for DACA based on not meeting the education criteria. According to our data sets, they appear not to be enrolled in school or have a high school diploma or GED. So as a reminder, as Jenna mentioned, DACA is tied to human capital. In order to apply, applicants need to have a high school diploma or GED or be currently enrolled in school at the time of their application. Now, USCIS defines currently enrolled in school as being in a regular elementary or secondary school or being enrolled in an education, literacy, or career training program that leads to placement in post-secondary education, job training, employment, or a GED. So in other words, for individuals who are not currently enrolled in traditional high schools and do not have this diploma already, the adult education and career training systems represent an important on-ramp to making themselves available, to availing themselves of the DACA opportunity. We estimate that the size of this group that does not meet these requirements is 423,000. This comprises 22% of the larger 1.9 million that Jana mentioned earlier. Compared to the group of youth who are currently eligible to apply for DACA, as both Jana and Michael mentioned, these groups have some very different characteristics. So I'm going to discuss some of those barriers that they may face, a set of about 5 individual barriers, as well as a couple of external barriers that may affect their abilities to avail themselves of DACA. First, this population has a much lower level of basic skills than their peers. 42% have not yet completed any high school grades. In addition, they have low levels of English proficiency. Over 2/3 have limited English proficiency, and this is by contrast to those who do meet DACA's education requirements. Only 1/3 of that population has limited English proficiency. The rest are bilingual or speak only English. So this finding definitely speaks to the need for ESL programs serving this lowest educated population who does not currently meet DACA's education requirements. Third, we have a finding that suggests that there is a high poverty rate among the population that does not currently meet the DACA education requirements. 3/4 live in families with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level. And so for this group, the cost and fees of tuition and fees for any type of adult education or career training program is likely to be a very significant factor influencing their access and decision to enroll in these programs, let alone their ability to apply for DACA. It's worth noting here that for DACA there is a $465 application fee, and there are currently no fee waivers and very, very few fee exemptions for extreme specific cases such as homelessness or disability. So in other words, this population does face a number of financial barriers to getting themselves ready to apply for DACA. A fourth factor that we found interesting is related to workforce participation. Among this group that's not currently enrolled in school and does not have a diploma or GED, a large number are actually working. The vast majority are in the workforce. And in fact, this group is also predominantly male. About 64% are young men, and many of these young men serve as the primary breadwinners for their families. These findings suggest a need for adult education and career training programs that are uniquely suited to this population, of working learners that have flexible schedules that may offer evening or weekend classes, and also that would offer programs that are relevant to a population that is seeking immediate labor market benefits, such as short-term career certificate programs. Another finding related to individual barriers and competing responsibilities is related to parenting. Since DACA is available for young adults up to age 31, a large number, you can expect the significant number, will have already had children of their own. In fact, we find that those who do not meet DACA's education requirements have a much higher rate of being parents. 31% are parents with young children living in the home, compared to just 11% of those who do meet the education criteria. So this group is particularly significant, and their outcomes are particularly significant because they have the potential to affect not only their own futures, but also the outcomes of the next generation. The vast majority of their children, one would assume, would be U.S.-born citizens. So obviously, access to affordable and reliable childcare will play a key role in whether these low-income working adults will be able to return to school and avail themselves of DACA. And finally, I wanted to mention a few external barriers, in addition to these individual-level factors, that may affect the success and uptake of the DACA, the potentially DACA-eligible population. First, unfortunately, DACA coincides with a time of deep cuts to public funding for adult education in many states, perhaps most notably in California, which unfortunately is also home to the largest number of potential DACA beneficiaries of any state. The adult education programs only met a fraction of the need for GED and English as a second language before the recession, and today their capacity is curtailed much further. Also, community colleges that are providing career training programs are over-enrolled in many places in both California and the nation. Second, there's another barrier related to legal status and ability to access adult education and career training. In most states, adult education, publicly funded adult education programs are provided at free or low cost to all residents of the state. However, in a few states, legislation specifically bars unauthorized immigrants from participating in these courses or requires them to pay a substantially higher fee, effectively closing this avenue to meeting DACA's education requirements in a couple of states. So in light of these findings, in summary, we conclude that maximizing DACA participation among this group with the lowest educational attainment, this 423,000 that we've been speaking about, really depends to a large extent on the availability, affordability, and quality of education and career training programs at the local and state levels. We think that DACA could be a powerful motivator for this population to continue their education and further their integration. However, this would be dependent on having appropriate programs and supports in place. So with that, I will turn it back to Michael, and I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thanks so much, Sarah. So we'll now turn to questions. I'm going to make just a couple observations, but I want to definitely invite the audience to tweet your questions to us using the hashtag #MPIDACA, or to email them to communications@migrationpolicy.org. We've been talking for about 30 minutes, so we'll get to a few questions and go on for another 10 to 15 minutes, we believe. First, I just wanted to say, before we go further, the context here, as DACA hits the one-year mark, is, of course, that Congress is debating comprehensive immigration reform, and the DREAM Act is very much a part of that discussion. It's definitely part of the Senate bill, which has been put forward, and that sort of begs the question, what's the difference between the DREAM Act and the DACA program? I won't go into a long, drawn-out thing, but I'll just mention that DREAM offers permanent status and a path to citizenship. DACA offers only temporary relief for 2 or 4 years. DREAM is enacted through congressional action, while DACA offers a kind of administrative relief. And finally, as Sarah has talked about, obtaining a green card under the DREAM Act requires a higher level of education The DREAM Act requires essentially completion of 2 years in college rather than qualifying for DACA, which requires a high school degree or current enrollment in a school or career training program. So with that, let's turn to a couple of very good questions that have come across the transom. The first question I want to is, New York State, one writer has written, has more immigrant infrastructure than Florida. What explains why the application rate is lower in New York? Let me just take a first swing at that pitch and just say part of this is demography. The immigrant population is older, it's more diverse, it is there's a lower proportion Hispanic, and as we've seen, Hispanics are have high turnout rates, or high application rates for DACA. There is a higher share, in this case, though, of Dominicans in New York, and Dominicans have particularly low application rates for DACA. Finally, I would just make the point that it's not necessarily a direct correlation between infrastructure and applications. It may be a little more sophisticated than that, in the sense that legal experts may be guiding some applicants to hold back and not to apply. So we don't know that there's definitely a one-for-one correlation there. I will also mention that New York is striking in the sense that the city legislature, city government, has just authorized $18 million to promote application for DACA and human capital development among DACA applicants. So that's my first swing at the pitch. I know Sarah has been in working a little bit with the city on this, and maybe she would like to add her voice to this.
Thanks. I think you mainly covered the points, Michael, in terms of the only conjectures that we can make about really the diversity of the population. We've also seen if the Mexican population has the highest application rate among all groups, but Mexican immigrants comprise a relatively small share of the immigrant population in New York City. That could be one factor. So I think that these, and that overall a higher share of New York's immigrants are from a wider variety of Asian groups as well that tend to have lower DACA application rates, as Jana discussed earlier. So that's about as far as I can guess on that one.
Okay. Here's a very good question which contains a lot of useful information for us. The question is, applicants under 15 can apply for DACA if they're currently in removal proceedings or if they were in removal proceedings in the past. They're the only exception to the 15 to 30 age limitation for applicants. Does the MPI report account for this population? And the writer asked, I asked because there is a rapidly growing number of minors who are or were detained, especially on or after June 15th, 2007, and I have served a number of under 15 clients, and I'm interested in this population in particular. Jana, do you want to weigh in on this question?
Sure. Unfortunately, first of all, we did not differentiate this population, a very important and, as you pointed out, growing population, because our data is based on the civilian population, so people who are not in custody. And for that reason, we weren't able to capture that population. So because of the data and limitations, we weren't able to identify the exact size or understand how fast this population grows or what their unique characteristics. But we are certainly aware that those who are in deportation proceedings, regardless of the age, can apply for DACA.
While we're on this point, we didn't go in our presentation, we didn't go into much detail about the younger population, about the under 15 population that's potentially eligible for DACA but is yet to age into eligibility. Sarah, did you want to say a few words on that population?
Sure, I'd be happy to. That's true that that is the third group that we looked at in our analysis, but really haven't devoted much time to yet today. But that group, our data actually indicate that approximately half of that group are ages 12 to 14, meaning that they could age into DACA eligibility immediately or very shortly. That population, we believe for the most part, is enrolled in elementary, middle, and high schools. And we do know that about 27% are English language learners. However, that includes even the very youngest population, youngest members of this population. So we would assume that a large number of them would gain full English proficiency as they move through the educational pipeline and get into the high school years. We also know that this group has a particularly high poverty rate, even higher than either of the other groups that we talked about. In fact, 85% have family incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level. And so for this group, I mean, I think that we can really look at this group as in some ways the easiest to reach, and the easiest to influence their outcomes, because they are still enrolled in educational institutions for the most part. They are under age 15, and they're growing up with the opportunity to apply for DACA in the near future, which could very much influence their decision to stay in school, serve as a motivating factor, also really provide the avenue to have a more normal teenage experience of, in many states, being able to obtain a driver's license as well as work authorization. So really factors that that could be great motivators for this group. Eventually, their ultimate impact of DACA on the post-secondary education, on the college-going aspirations of this group, remains to be seen. We can certainly expect that a significant share would, that DACA would open up the opportunity to think about and to apply for and enroll in post-secondary education. However, for some members, especially of the lowest income group and those with the most immediate financial needs, the opportunity to apply for DACA once they turn 15 may also influence some to pursue working full-time because of the immediate need to support their families. So we are definitely interested in doing further research on that group.
That's right. I mean, DACA could have two effects. It could induce people to stay in school to take advantage of, because in the long term, their human capital, accumulated human capital, may be more valuable. Or it, for many people, it could be the first opportunity I have to work legally and with a driver's license, and could induce them, induce some people who are hiding out in school because of the recession actually to leave. So here's another question that it's that I think I can answer, but I'm going to ask Jana to go a little bit beyond it. Do you have any city level data? And if so, did you find anything unique about New York City? We don't have city-level data within the report. The question is, what's the potential in the future using this data set? Jana?
Yes, unfortunately, we don't have the city-level data, but we expect that there will be significant variation by cities as well for the reasons that we mentioned earlier, you know, the availability of the networks, the concentration of certain groups in certain cities, the age distribution, as both Sarah and Michael mentioned earlier, those who are younger, they have not only they are likely to have easier time to submit all the documents documenting their presence in the United States on a certain date. They have school records. They have as well as they have high school and community college counselors who are very aware of the program and the requirements and can point them to write directions on and provide solid advice on whether to apply and which conditions, things like that. So all of these factors will play perhaps even a greater role at the city level because the state data will kind of mask the within the state differences. But the national origin, the kind of the interplay between demographics and other factors will play a major role in why we would see perhaps higher rates of application from Los Angeles than from New York or Miami.
Thank you. Here's another good question. It's a question that we've grappled with. Is 49% a successful application rate for this type, for a program of this type? That's a very good question. If you look at it through a historical lens, for example, we were talking today about application rates among the eligible population in the first year after the passage of the Immigration Reform and Control Act in 1986, those rates were initially about 20%, and then they were reasonably low for the next several years, and then at the close of that program, the rates went up strongly and substantially. So viewed through that historical lens, this looks pretty good. Sarah, do you have any other thoughts on how to assess this 49% number?
Sure. I mean, I think that it's an interesting question, and it's sort of a glass half full, glass half empty thing when we have half applying and half who have not yet been able to. On the one hand, it is quite impressive, as Michael has mentioned, that we've had over 500,000 people come forward and submit everything that they need to apply for DACA. That said, we, as both Shauna and I have discussed, there could be substantial barriers that remain for those that have not yet applied. And among the population that has not yet applied, some may have barriers due to the cost of the program and financial needs. Some may also not be coming forward and applying out of fear of bringing themselves forward and exposing themselves and their families as unauthorized. We could see factors in people sort of waiting to see what happens with immigration reform legislation in Congress and kind of waiting around to figure out if now is the right time to apply for DACA, and understanding then that they could apply for DACA defensively if placed in deportation proceedings. So there could be many reasons that people have not yet come forward and that we may not see the outreach to that additional 50%. We don't know yet.
And I would just add to that, 49% is the share of the currently eligible, that is to say age at arrival and education requirements, that's the share of that population that has come forward and applied. If we were to add the population of potentially eligible in terms of age at arrival but not education, the total application rate would drop to 36%. So that's a different lens through which to look at these numbers that we present in this report. Here's a very good question that we have been grappling with for some time with this report, and I'll just read it out. Just to be clear, the 423,000 who you know, Sarah, are potentially eligible but appear not to meet the education requirement. Some of these folks surely are eligible right now. It's just that the data isn't available to tell us how many are currently enrolled in adult education, literacy, and career. Is this correct? It's a picky point. It's not just a picky point. It's a very good point. But I just want to make sure I understand what you're reporting. And then there's a second question. Do you know of any efforts, perhaps maybe at the state level, to try to estimate the number of enrolled adult education students who are DACA eligible? Sarah, why don't you start, and then Jana, maybe you can weigh in.
Sure. And that certainly is a valid and good question that we have been talking about, as Michael mentioned. It is certainly true that some number of that 423,000 have likely come forward since our data reflect 2011 estimates of school enrollment. So there's definitely a chance that some number have enrolled in adult education career training programs since that time, and that number may be lower. However, you know, because of the many barriers that I discussed previously, such as low capacity in a lot of adult education programs, some of the other barriers such as poverty, parenting, and working, we don't necessarily expect that would be an astronomical number that would very much change our data set because of their because of the fact that that many would have changed their education status to now be eligible for DACA. In terms of, I think, the second part of the question, which was looking at, do we have any ability to capture, to look at the population that is enrolled in adult education or career training programs? In our data at this point, we really don't. We are certainly interested in trying to get to look at that information. USCIS has not released any data on the educational attainment of applicants, so we don't even know what fraction of applicants are enrolled in GED programs or programs below a high school diploma level. Jana, do you have additional thoughts on that?
Well, I'll be a good researcher that ends any kind of paper with a statement that more research is needed on this topic. But that's the case, in particular about the sensitive populations such as the undocumented population. It's a very important population from the policy and program point of view, yet we are at the very early stage of exploring the characteristics, estimating the size, understanding motivations and the reasons why certain why some people apply and others don't. So from our other work on immigrants by generation or immigrants by limited English proficiency status, we find that state and local agencies, educational agencies, or adult education programs, they typically do not track information by immigrant status or generation status or undocumented status. So it's often extremely hard. You really need to piecemeal small data points together in order to get a better picture, not even a perfect picture of a certain population. So as far as I know, such data are not collected consistently or in a consistent way across different agencies or different states. So we hope that for those who are with us on this video chat are in the position of asking for such data collection, please use that leverage. We definitely would like to incorporate in our data analysis and provide a fuller picture. But as I mentioned, we are in the early stage, and a lot is unknown still.
Here's a question. Sarah, I wanted to see if you can take this one on. I would like to ask about the types of outreach effort that have been conducted by USCIS in order to share DOC information with the target population and encourage them to apply. That hasn't been obviously the subject of our own work here, but do you have any anecdotal information that you can provide or offer to the writer?
Sure. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be able to speak much to outreach conducted by USCIS. I know that the various immigrant advocacy organizations and coalitions nationally have been very involved in providing outreach, informational outreach, legal assistance, education about who qualifies for DACA and who does not, in a number of major metropolitan areas, in a number of states. A group that we would definitely mention as a real leader in that area is United We Dream, a national network targeting this population, but also in many cases legal services groups have played a very active role in providing, as mentioned, information about what the program is, helping to dispel some of the myths about and fear that people may have about coming forward and applying for the program, helping to answer questions about who may be eligible. And then we've also heard that colleges and even high schools have played a key role is providers of information and outreach that and that guidance counselors in high schools are being called upon to play that role to a large extent, to have information on how to assist youth in applying for DACA and what rights it confers, what rights it does not confer. So I think that that's mainly what we have heard in terms of the main avenues by which youth are learning about the program, are learning about the different benefits of the program, and also I think still watching to see what may happen with comprehensive immigration reform or the DREAM Act.
Here's a tough question, so I'll pass it on. If CIR is not passed, everybody put your thinking caps on, can data estimate the amount of human capital that the economy is underutilizing and the costs and losses involved? Of course, one way to think about this question is to think back, to look at the unauthorized population and to think back and to model it against what happened in the wake of the Immigration Reform and Control Act in terms of rising incomes among the legalizing population and changing educational attainment among the legalizing population is one way to think of this question. Do we have any other thoughts on this? This is a tough one.
Well, we looked at the school enrollment and education of the currently eligible population for DACA, and we find that about 30%, so a third, they are either currently enrolled in college or already have at least an associate level degree. So we, for this population, having no pathway to legal employment in the mainstream economy will bring disadvantages not only for these individuals but also to the economy of the communities in which they live, because the investments made into the education would not be recouped. So that's another kind of angle through which we can look at. And then we estimate that a large share, about a quarter, are still in elementary and middle and high schools, so who haven't applied yet but will be eligible soon. So what will happen with this population and the opportunities for their economic contribution? So we already have a substantial number of people who are pursuing education in one way or another, either at the secondary or post-secondary level. So the loss of human capital, the brain waste of this population will have negative implications for the economy overall.
I'm going to read a comment that was sent in, and then that will be our final response for the session. And in this case, I will name the writer, Jana Evans, the regional lead for community relations of USCIS in the Western region, wrote, "We did as much outreach on DACA as we could, and that is one reason the applications came in relatively good shape. And we can provide that data to you on the number of events, the numbers of people reached, et cetera, if you like." Thank you very much for that information, Jana. I'd like to thank you all very much for watching this video. And I'd like to thank Sarah and Jana. And here at MPI, I'd like to thank Michelle Mittelstadt and Lisa Dixon. And for our viewers, for the last time, thank you for the interest and for those really, really good questions. The video of this chat will be available on our website within a few minutes, and we'll be doing more of these chats and releasing additional research on key facets of the U.S. immigration debate in the coming weeks. So please stay tuned at www.migrationpolicy.org. Thank you all for your time.